Hello and welcome to Hired the Podcast. Today I am incredibly excited to bring the newest member of Mill Resource Group on board to join us, Alex Shahofsky. Alex is a noted speaker and noted analyst. He is going to be doing a deep dive on the attraction, hiring, and retention strategies for companies. We start off the show talking a little bit about how and why he chose to join Miller Resource Group, but very quickly we get into the current state of the economy as it relates to hiring. Spent a lot of time talking about the manufacturing sector, the effect automation has had, and then we go on to talk about how companies can future prep their workforce. We coined that phrase during the episode. It's not future proof because that's impossible, but talking about how to future prep your career and your employees so that all of you can get on board with the mission and have a tremendous and ideally loyal lifelong career together, achieving something great. And we finish off the show talking a little bit about what future he is prepping for here with us here at Miller Resource Group. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Here I go, ready now, I'm coming for you. I got some things I gotta do. I'm making a move. Alex, thank you so much for being with us here today on Hired the Podcast. World, I'd like to introduce you to Alex Shahofsky, newest team member of Miller Resource Group. Alex, tell us a little bit about your journey that brought you here with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Travis. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm really excited to be a part of such a great organization that really addresses what I see as a critical need in the business world, which of course is the need for talent, for growth, to enable companies to become the best versions of themselves. And the journey for me to get here is quite an interesting one. So I come from an organization called ITR Economics, where I spent the last 6 years advising and consulting with companies on business operations, on things like capital investment, on hiring, on supply chain, certainly capacity planning. And one of the things that I really consistently saw over my tenure at that company was that in some cases, companies didn't realize that people were by far their most important, most critical asset. When you talk about the economy, as I did in my previous job, you notice that the rising tide lifts all boats, if you will. So when the economy is doing well, companies are really doing well. When the economy does not do well, you can see all companies are hurt by this. But what is challenging is to use analytics and data from an economic perspective to really help companies separate themselves from the competition. And I saw a real opportunity when it comes to this greatest asset that companies own, which is people, to help advise companies on the best practices when it comes to attracting talent, to the best in case practices for hiring that talent and certainly for retaining that talent. And that leading to some opportunities for companies to really separate themselves, be standout recruiters, be standout retainers of that talent, and really see some terrific performance as a result of being best in class hirers. So that's what made me really excited to come to the Miller Resource Group and to build this analytics and consulting practice here, which will obviously leverage the decades of expertise and the tremendous and very valuable data that Miller Resource Group has at its disposal as a result of placing thousands of candidates in various positions, ranging from engineering to sales to marketing and, some of the C-suite positions that MRG has placed candidates into for many, many years. So I'm very excited to get started with this work and can't wait to see what the outcome is going to be.
So you spent the last number of years focused on studying the trends and analyzing economic data. But I'm sure through seeing that data, you've seen a number of things in the attracting, hiring, and retention world that affect companies and affect the economy both on a micro and macro scale. I'm curious what you've seen about how companies utilize that best asset, their people, to affect their own economic standing and the economy as a whole.
Yeah, it's a terrific question. So one of the first things that I noticed when I looked at the economy and on specific company performance as it relates to what's going on in that industry or in the macroeconomic landscape overall is that business leaders tend to be very reactive rather than proactive. And so what I mean by that is they tend to turn the dial up on hiring during the busiest phase of their business cycle when their companies are accelerating and can't keep up with demand. And they tend to do the exact opposite during periods of downturn, which, you know, when you think about it psychologically, makes sense why the human element would cause you to have this behavior. But when it comes to practice and the impact that that has, it's actually the exact opposite of what you should be doing. Because as a company is accelerating and reaching the peak of its own business cycle performance, that's actually the time for them to start being a little bit more conservative, realizing that this kind of acceleration is not going to continue forever. One of the issues that we consistently ran into is this straight line thinking mentality that C-suite executives employ. They think, well, the times are good, they're going to be good forever, I need to really ramp up and hire a bunch of people. The reality is times don't last forever, whether good or bad. Eventually, that period of acceleration turns into a period of slower growth and eventually, in many times, a contraction for that company's business. And so they're left over with this swell of talent and not enough demand to justify that performance. Vice versa, on the flip side of that cycle, at the low point, when everybody else is thinking about cutting talent and letting go of its experts and seasoned professionals, the smart guys are actually looking to hire. You want to bring on that asset early on in the period of rise so that you can transition these people and ramp them up and have them be effective contributing members to your organization when the times are busy. So that was one of the first things that I really noticed is that it's really counterintuitive when companies should really be pulling the trigger on those hires. And right now is a really great example of that. We're near the peak of a business cycle in, you know, mid to late 2021. Most companies cannot keep up with demand. And consistently, one of the things that I was hearing from the consulting clients that I interacted with was, we would be growing so much faster if only we had the talent. But the time to have brought that talent on board was back in 2020, kind of the late spring, early summer period when everybody else was cutting staff, when there was more availability of labor in the labor pool, and very few organizations thought about doing that. And as a result, as you can see, fairly consistently across the board, especially in the manufacturing sector, you can see it right now, companies simply don't have the people to keep up with the level of demand, creating these supply chain shortages that we're facing and all of the limitations on growth that businesses are currently grappling with.
I think you hit it on the head. I think 2020, 2021 is a perfect example. You could almost, it's almost like they drew it up in a lab. At the beginning of 2020, when everybody was so concerned with what the future looked like and they had no idea what was going on, a lot of them, and justifiably, panicked a little bit and hiring freezes and cutting staff and cutting hours and letting a lot of people go just because there was that uncertainty and they had a tough time understanding how they were going to be able to utilize that talent now and picturing what that use was going to look like in the future. But now, when production has continued to increase, I mean, the economy is doing tremendous right now. Everybody is looking for people right now. And it is that candidate-driven market, because with everybody looking for people, anybody who wants a new position in these highly skilled areas can pretty much go out and find it. So how do people remember that the next time something happens? Because there is going to be a next time. The economy is up now, hiring is good, but there is going to be a downturn at some point in the future. How do companies remember that?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. I just immediately went to say that you have to learn from the mistakes of the past, right, Travis? You have to be able to say, okay, the pain that I'm going through right now, how do I make sure that I don't have the same limitations, the same kind of constraints on my business when I look toward the future? And this realization is more important now than ever before, because we've entered this new dynamic of there simply is not enough labor to meet the all of the open positions that are out there. And I really struggle to envision a future where that dynamic changes significantly. Using some recent data points, I mean, there are nearly 500,000 open manufacturing positions in the United States right now. People see these unemployment numbers, right? Where we're at, you know, 5.5% unemployment right now or thereabouts. There's like 7.5 million people unemployed. But it's this kind of confusion about how do you reconcile those two things together? How can there be so many people that are still unemployed, and yet at the same time, you have 500,000 open manufacturing positions? Shouldn't those candidates be available to fill those positions? And the reality is the devil is always in the details. When you look at those millions of unemployed people, they're predominantly in specific sectors that have really been affected by the pandemic. It's leisure and hospitality. It's the travel industry. It's, you know, retail. Still, people, you know, are somewhat limited. We've shifted our buying habits. We're now buying so many more products online, including things that we never used to buy online, like groceries and other goods. So the reality is that, yes, there are still millions of people unemployed, but the key skilled positions that we're talking about, manufacturing, engineering, you know, the top salesmen even, and marketing and digital content creators, those are still very much in demand and simply not enough people to fill those positions. So when you take that and realize that, okay, I need to hire at the low points in the business cycle, you have to realize that you can't not have this mentality of, I go to my workforce as a cutting mechanism to save costs, because long term, it's going to be a significantly hampering factor for me, and it's going to prevent me from being able to achieve the growth plans that I have for myself longer term. Perfect example, I worked with several clients, some of them cut, as you mentioned, in the middle of 2020. Others implemented a program that was really designed to work with their employees to introduce some flexibility, perhaps lower some of their hours, but they didn't let anybody go. And I can tell you, I saw it in the business performance that they ramped up much faster coming out of the pandemic, and they continued to gain share and outperform their competitors as a result of that comprehensive and strategic decision-making that they had relative to their workforce. So I think it's absolutely critical that companies change that mindset and realize you, especially with your medium and top performers, these are not assets that you can cut even when times are a little bit tougher. You've got to think long-term with this.
Mm-hmm. Help me figure something out, Alex. So, you know, for years and years, we heard that automation was going to kill the manufacturing job. And companies are more automated today than they have ever been. But as you mentioned, would you say over 5 million?
Nearly 500,000 open manufacturing positions.
Open positions in manufacturing.
Yeah.
These companies are more automated than ever. What the hell? How did that happen? What's going on that companies are getting more automated, but there's still not enough people to produce all the goods that are in demand?
Yeah. So there's a really interesting disconnect that people have. There's this misconception that manufacturing has been dying and fleeing the US over the years. And that was certainly true when you look back at the 90s and the early 2000s. Many of the kind of traditional manufacturing sectors, especially industries where there is high volume production, very little customization or complexity in the products that are being made, they did go to places like China and India and Southeast Asia, where the labor is cheap and, you know, they can just make these widgets over and over and over again. But the reality is that when you look at the manufacturing output in the United States, we're at or near record levels right now. In fact, I think we're at record highs. And so despite the fact that the number of manufacturing jobs is nowhere near the size that it was back in the late 90s, early 2000s, we've gone from, I would say, roughly 20 million people employed in manufacturing to about 12 and a half million right now, but the volume of output continues to increase, and in many cases exponentially, especially in the high value add industries. You talk about technology, you talk about, you know, highly engineered products in the industrial space. All of these things require a great deal of expertise, the ability to engage with your customers, to meet their needs, and that can't be done through outsourced labor. I worked with a company out of California that initially outsourced the production of circuit boards, printed circuit boards, to China. And what they discovered was the issues in terms of lead time to get product back to the U.S., the quality control issues that they were having with those particular products, and just the difficulty in operating within the Chinese environment made it actually more profitable for them to bring that manufacturing back to California, of all places, right? One of the most expensive places in the U.S. to do business. And yet, for such a interesting low-end product, it required customization. They had some customers in the military and defense space, for example, that required high-quality assurance. And so it wasn't worth it for them to realize the cost savings and the materials and then the labor because of all of the redo type of activity that they had to do with some of their customers. So it's a perfect example of how people need to really change this, the way that they think about the manufacturing sector. We are certainly going to continue to see the advancement of manufacturing in the United States. There's a lot of really positive things that drive that. For example, some of the, in fact, the majority of the top universities in the world are right here in the U.S. I think we have 7 or 8 of the top 10. And so the talent wants to be here in the U.S. That's going to drive innovation, that's going to drive new product development, and that's going to continue to boost manufacturing. So this idea that manufacturing is dying is so outdated, and that's why we have all of these new positions. These are, you know, programmers and service techs and, you know, people that work on the automation part that actually produces things, right? They're service guys, they're the designers, the engineers. And so I think it's a trend that is likely to continue, at least for the next decade, if not longer, that it's going to be quite a favorable time for U.S. manufacturing as we look out to the 2020s.
For people that do work in manufacturing or are considering a career in manufacturing, what are steps they can take now? What are things that they can do to future-proof their careers against what the changes in manufacturing and the industry is going to look like 5, 10, 20 years down the road?
Yeah, it's a really tough thing to answer, but I think the way that I would respond would be, it doesn't just apply to manufacturing, right? I think this idea that you go to college and you get a degree, and then at some point, maybe you go to get your MBA or a master's degree of some sort, and then you use that education to successfully navigate the next 40 years of your career, that idea is also extremely outdated, in my opinion. I think the reality is, in today's very quickly evolving world, you have to be constantly challenging yourself to stay up with the times, whether that means learning to program, whether it means staying on top of the latest technologies. One of the concepts that really came to the forefront during the pandemic and is getting increased both investment and awareness from the business community is this idea of the metaverse. It's essentially the next iteration of digitization of the human race. So if you think about the advancement of computers in the 90s, you know, you had to be in front of your computer terminal and use dial-up modems. Then we eventually transitioned to computers on our handheld devices, our phones and our tablets that allow us to be connected anywhere. So the metaverse is essentially the next iteration of that, where you are integrating augmented reality and virtual reality in with your digital experience. So there's an entire online world out there that's going to be built over the coming decades. And certainly companies need to be aware of it. Think about where they fit into that world and how they can best position themselves to be early advancers in that world in order to be really competitive, for the long-term perspective. So I think all of that is basically to say that you have to have this desire, this hunger to stay relevant. You can certainly hit the cruise control button, get to a comfortable level of compensation and sail through your career. But I think that the successful candidates, as we look towards the future, are going to be ones that are constantly asking, what's next? How do I continue to improve my skill set? What other classes, what other certifications do I need to be relevant in my current position or even in other positions? Because I think the boundaries of the different jobs are getting increasingly murky and they're dissolving, especially with this advancement of remote work that we've seen over the last 18 months. I mean, it's really accelerated. So to answer your question is you have to continue to challenge yourself to stay relevant in a rapidly advancing type of job market and realize that many of the jobs of the 2030s have not yet even been invented. So if you want to continue to grow, you got to stay current.
Yeah, it's not that the world wasn't always changing. I mean, the amount of the difference between the world now and 100 years ago is enormous, but the difference between the world in 1940 and 1970 is nowhere near as great as the difference between the world now and the world 7 years ago now. Yeah. And the skills that are going to be needed for the jobs that you mentioned that we don't even know exist 10 years from now, there has to be, I think to, maybe I used the wrong word earlier. There is no way to future-proof your career because the future is happening so rapidly. But the people that are going to continue to achieve high levels of success are always looking at that future and preparing for what the next 2, 3, 4, 5 advancements are going to be. I mean, look at us. Who the hell would have thought that two schmoes would be recording a podcast for thousands of people to see 10 years ago?
Yeah.
I mean, it's people said that radio was a dying medium. Well, in a manner of speaking, they're right, but it's not that radio died, it just shifted. And I think that's happening to almost every industry. And so people, future-proofing is not a thing, but future-prepping.
Future-prepping, exactly right. And I think the key skill, the key element of who you are that needs to be there for you to future prep yourself is being willing to change. Like this notion that you're static has to be discarded. You are an evolving human being. You are someone who is constantly growing and increasing in experience and knowledge. And that adaptability is going to be absolutely key. Certainly is going to be the differentiating factor between those that are successful 10, 20 years from now and those that are going to be the same type of, having the same kind of reaction that many people in the manufacturing domain had as automation came in, is that, well, you know, it's not fair. It's not fair that I'm no longer able to make $25 an hour on an automotive assembly line. Well, life isn't fair, but life is real and you have to adapt to the reality. I guess the best way that I like to put things into context for people based on what you were saying is I remind them that this device did not exist before 2007. And I will challenge just about anyone in the workforce today to get along for a week without their cell phone. It's essentially impossible, right? You have access to all of the world's information at your fingertips. I traveled a lot for work in my previous role. I will be traveling again for a Miller Resource Group. And I can tell you many times, I don't even know where I'm going, where I'm staying, how I'm going to get there until I land in the destination, right? And that's impossible given, the lack of this kind of device. So I think it's a really perfect example to summarize how much our lives have changed in the last literally 13, 14 years and how much more change is coming, because I'll remind you that change is exponential. It's not linear. It's only happening at an accelerating pace over time.
Mm-hmm. I think back to the old model where you went to college, you got a degree, you got a job, you did well at that job. They promoted you to the next level doing a similar job. And you did that 4 or 5 times in your career. And then you retired at 65. And I just don't think that's even possible anymore. So what can companies do to... And I like this term. I'm going to look it up after we're done. And if not, I'm patenting, but future prep. What can companies do to future prep their workforce to encourage this consistent development for the next level, the next skills, the next areas? What can they do to encourage their team to always be learning, advancing, so that they can adapt to the next changes coming?
Yeah, I think that there are two absolutely vital things that companies have to do. The first thing, I think, is kind of the foundation for the second element, and that is you cannot think of the relationship you have with your employees as one directional. You are not the employer and they are the employees. You are partners in an initiative that seeks to achieve common goals. And when you change the way that you think about that, when you realize that the people that work for you are actually people that work with you, it is in your best interest to not only create some resiliency in the organization by allowing for multiple skill sets to be developed, but it's also certainly something that will be an enticement for people to stay if they can have new challenges and new opportunities to grow, you know, in this evolving jobs market. Then I think that your retention rates are likely to benefit from that. So the successful companies that I've seen all have some sort of system in place that allow for a learning of other responsibilities and tasks in addition to your primary job function. It creates that redundancy in case that particular individual is somehow either sick with COVID, for example, or leaves to take another job. So you're not as vulnerable to the hits to your organization when you do that. But it creates that kind of urgency in the people's minds that work for you and with you, that they need to continue to grow to be keeping pace with what the organization is trying to achieve. And it, you know, from all of the experiences that I've had with this, this has always been perceived as a very positive thing from the employee's perspective, that the company is willing to invest in my development in order for me to be happy in with the job that I'm doing, in order for me to continue to generate new ideas and to contribute to the stated joint goals that we've had together. So I think that's really, you know, the key element is think about it as a partnership with mutual interests and mutual goals rather than this one directional relationship.
It's a great way to look at it. And it's something we've really, really tried to own here at Miller Resource Group. And it's a mindset. I've tried to ever use the phrase, this person works for Miller Resource Group, because they don't work for Miller Resource Group. They have chosen to call Miller Resource Group their work home. And our biggest job as people that are steering the direction of Miller Resource Group, our biggest responsibility is to do everything that we can to make sure that they are as successful and as productive and they enjoy their work as much as they possibly can and as much as they want to. Because at any point, they can choose not to work here. At any point.
Yeah.
And if we are not providing an environment where they feel valued, where they feel successful, where they feel like they have the ability to grow as much as they want, then they probably should make that choice, because the great companies are out there and they are going to provide that environment for them.
You're absolutely right. I have managed people in my past roles, and I always encouraged my people to be looking around. It's a disservice to the people that you're trying to mentor and to bring up if you're not encouraging them. You know, I find companies make this mistake all the time. They hire people that they think are the smartest, most capable, best candidates, and then they don't treat them as such after they're already on board. It's a fascinating thing. But that actually brings me to the second point that builds on the foundation, which is to say that I firmly believe that in order to get people to behave in a certain way, you've got to find ways to incentivize that behavior. And that incentivization can take on many different forms. For example, some organizations say, yeah, here's all these courses that are available to you, but you've got to put in extra hours beyond your normal 40, 45, 50 hour work week in order to take advantage of them. You know, a lot of times that prevents people from actually taking advantage of great resources that the company has invested a lot of money into. So creating opportunities within the work week for them to take advantage of those courses. That's a really great element. Having some sort of reward system or recognition system for completing a certain amount of learning initiatives and new courses. That's another great system. But there are a multitude of ways that you can incentivize this type of behavior, but you have to realize that if you want people to behave a certain way, there's got to be a reason for them to do so. And you have to make that reason very clear, and you have to tie it back to the mission statement of your organization. That's, I think, a very important element of this.
And it's funny, you mentioned, you know, encouraging your people to be looking. I remember a story back when I was still working a desk, when I was still working as a recruiter. I called a gentleman up, and I was trying to recruit him for a position. And he said, no, that job's not me. That's the job I was doing 10 years ago. But here, let me give you the names and numbers of all of the people who are working for me now that I think might be a good fit for this role. And it took me aback. And I said, you mean the people that used to work for you? He goes, no, I'll give you the people on my team. I mean, it sounds like it's probably a pretty good opportunity. You talk to them, find out what they're looking for. And if it is the right opportunity for them, for their career, for their growth, then absolutely they should hear about it. And I'll tell you what, I talked to those people and not a one would even consider leaving that company for 1 second.
Yeah, it's really fascinating because the story that you just told seems like clearly the exception to the rule, right? It's so palpable because surely no manager would want to push for the advancement of their employees. But the outcome of that story that you just highlighted shows exactly why that manager is so successful at retaining their talent. They have their best interests in mind. And that was always my approach. And I'm really shocked at how some organizations take that knowledge, that power, and concentrate it at the very top, and they fear disseminating that empowerment to their employees, and because they think of the worst possible outcomes. But the reality is, the more you empower your people, the more they're likely to want to work for you. Right? That's a key element that I think a lot of the old school thinking is missing on. And again, you know, the younger generations in particular, there's not this idea of loyalty that's built in. There's not this expectation that you're going to go into the job market and work for a single company for 30 or 40 years the way that there was when a lot of, for example, the baby boomers were coming up. And so I think it's really important for people to recognize that this change has occurred and embrace it in order to be successful and to, again, adapt to the reality of the job market today.
Yeah, I do want to push back on that a little bit, though, Alex, that loyalty piece, because I think it's a different form of loyalty. There's not that blind loyalty, where loyalty for loyalty's sake. I'm not loyal to this company because this company gave me a job. I don't think that exists anymore. But I do think there is a desire for people to find a company that they can believe in. And if the company gives them a reason to be loyal, if there is a great and grand why of what the company is trying to accomplish, and the person feels like a partner in accomplishing that why, I think there is a desire to have that loyalty to a mission, not necessarily a loyalty to a brand.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think you have to earn the loyalty. It's not actually built in. So you're correct on all fronts there.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think companies can do to encourage that loyalty? Because I do think the loyalty is there if it is earned, but you can't expect that blind loyalty anymore. So what can companies do to encourage their best people to want to be on board, to be a partner in achieving that mission?
So in my career, I've had very different styles of management applied to me. And I can tell you what I tend to think works in order to get loyalty is a few things. First and foremost, I think transparency is absolutely paramount. Don't try to feed me some BS when you and I both know that it's not true because you're being told to do so, right? I think you have to be honest with your people. You have to tell them the reality of the situation, but you can't sugarcoat it and you can't try to spin it into something that it's not. So I think if somebody is direct, open, and honest with me, I have, you know, way more respect for that person, that someone that tries to take the edge off and tries to sugarcoat things for me. The second element is actually related to that, and I alluded to it earlier, and that is to say, treat me as the intelligent person that you hired. Don't try to take advantage of me and think that I'm not going to be able to keep up with the reality, because unfortunately, that happens all the time. The office gossip, the talking behind people's back, the sharing of information. I mean, one of the things that I find really fascinating is that, especially in the younger generations, almost half of all millennials, for example, openly talk about their compensation with their peers. It is no longer a taboo topic. So everybody knows what everybody else is making. Glassdoor, Indeed, LinkedIn, all of these things are great tools to substantiate those numbers. And so when companies are talking about, for example, salary raises and compensation changes, I see this all the time. A person who is a top performer will come to their boss and they'll say, I would like a raise. I think here are the reasons why I feel like I deserve it, and I would like you to consider giving me a raise. The response from the boss is typically, I'm sorry, the budget has no room for that raise. There's no way, nothing I can do. It's out of my hands. That person then says, okay, obviously my performance is not being rewarded here. So they start looking for another job. And sure enough, they find a position that's offering them 10, 20, 30, sometimes 50% more than what they're making. And then at that point, they come to their boss and they say, okay, well, I appreciate everything I've learned here, but I'm leaving this job and going to take this other opportunity because the pay is so much better. And at that point, something all of a sudden magically happens and money is found in the budget to give that person a raise and a potential promotion. And the unfortunate part of it is, in vast majority of the cases, it's too late. The person has lost trust and respect for the organization. They have lost trust and respect for their boss. And there's really nothing that you can do to take that kind of situation back. And so I think that transparency and honesty and the recognition and willingness to reward top performers and people that are truly contributing to their organization has to be there. That's a huge thing for retention. And it has been for me. I've worked for bosses that were really good with it, and I've worked for others that were not so good. And I can tell you where my loyalty laid was very obvious to me.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that's easier to do for small to mid-sized companies. The people that I see having the biggest challenge are people that work in the much larger organizations where there is a corporate structure that position A gets paid equivalent to A, and if there's a top performer, they literally don't have the ability to give that person a raise without a promotion, or somebody's coming in from the outside for that job that is worthy of significantly more money, but they just can't make any changes. Do you have any advice for people working at those larger companies on how they can grow, build, and reward their team?
I think that the desire to make things different than they have been in the past stems from success of retaining talent historically. So what I mean by that is, yes, I completely understand the point that you're making, that there are more rigid structures in place in a big corporation. There are certainly bands of salary and things of that nature, but there are many intangible rewards and non-financial compensation elements that are at the discretion of the manager themselves. So that could involve, if you're talking about a younger person, they want more flexibility, that might be able to say, okay, if I'm going to measure you on your output rather than on your time, your butts in seats kind of mentality, mm-hmm. right? The time in office. So if you can get the job done in Monday through Thursday type of schedule, take Fridays off. Do pursue your personal passions on Fridays. Take care of all your chores. That way your weekends are free and available to you to really enjoy and to unwind. But if I can just get the desired output from you 4 days a week rather than 5 days a week, I'm fine with that, right? We're talking about, in many cases, salaried positions here, and you're not clocking in and clocking out. So why are you going to expect that person to be at their desk at 8 o'clock and then, you know, you don't want them to leave until 5 p.m.? If they can get the job done, that's what the benchmark is. That's where the bar is, right?
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are doing that working from home now, and I question why so many companies are requiring their people to come back to the office if they've been successful when working from home. Do they not trust their employees, or are their employees not worthy of that trust? And either one is a problem that's not necessarily going to be solved by being back in the office.
No. And you're absolutely right. And it's this, the answer is very simple. It's, we've always done it this way. That is the mantra that permeates particularly senior management and corporate structures. We've always done it this way. It's been effective. We don't want to break the mold. But I can tell you, the mold is being broken, whether you want it to or not. Perfect example. I walk to the corner of my street to pick up my kids from the bus stop every day in the afternoon. And there is a gentleman that lives on my street that does the same. And we get to talking. And he told me this fascinating story just a few days ago. He says he works for an engineering team for a major financial services provider. They went remote for the last 18 months as a result of the pandemic. And now the company is saying, you have to come back to the office at least 3 days a week, if not four in some cases. And what they've resulted in, that policy has resulted in a 30% attrition rate on his team. People are saying, if you're not willing to be flexible and work with me on this, even though I've shown you consistently for a year and a half that I can produce from the remote environment, then I'm going to find somebody else who can. And that's exactly what they're doing. So I think it's this old adage of, well, if it ain't broken, don't fix it. But the reality is, it is broken. You just don't recognize the fact that it's broken.
Mm-hmm. Alex, thanks so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it. So what's next for you and your future at Miller Resource Group?
Oh, man. Travis, so many exciting things. We've got a blank canvas over here that we're exploring with all sorts of colors and paints. And some of the initial ideas that we have are, developing reliable analytics for everything ranging from attraction to best-in-class hiring practices to retention practices, a way to potentially develop some quantifiable way to measure a particular company's effectiveness when it comes to these types of activities. We're going to be delivering that content in webinars and in-person keynotes at industry and trade association events, at big trade shows, and even, yes, at company boardroom meetings, because one of the goals that we have is to consult businesses one-on-one on how to become that best-in-class attractor, hirer, and retainer of talent. A lot of times, companies right now don't even know where they fall on the spectrum. So the first thing about fixing that is you got to evaluate it somehow. We're doing the work to get that rolling right now. And then applying that to the specific nuances of each company's business and really helping them understand what do they need to focus on to drive actionable and practical change in their organization. Where are they lagging versus excelling, and how do they make things better? Because that's going to be the difference maker for them as you look out to the future, whether they succeed or fail, unfortunately. So lots of different things in the works. We'll keep everybody up to date through various blog posts and certainly videos like this and podcasts. And I hope to see people on the road once things settle down a little bit with COVID. So very exciting times indeed.
Very exciting. We're going to be watching it with anticipation. And Alex, the more you can help companies become that place that values their employees and creates an environment where people are excited about their work they're doing and have the ability to do the best work possible that they can do, you're making the world a better place one day at a time, my friend.
Yes, sir. I'm excited about the opportunity, and I look forward to working with all of you in some capacity in the future.
Alex, thanks so much. Make it a great day, everyone.
Thanks. Take care.
Thank you again to Alex today for joining us. It was a real pleasure speaking with him. Please make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave that 5-star review ranking. And if you liked what you heard, please leave a review. We'd all appreciate it. Have a great one, everyone. I'm making a move. On me.